Okay, so I'll move on to public records. Now, I always give this disclaimer or warning, I guess, at the beginning, because public records, we have a lot of cases now in this state involving the Public Records Act. And if you were to survey those cases, you'd find that most of them are successful. Not all of them, but most of them are successful. And you find, if you scour the newspapers enough, you find commonly that agencies are settling with public records requesters before the case even gets to court or shortly after it has been filed, because the agency knows that they're not going to prevail. A couple years ago, there was a public records request that was made, and I represented Snohomish County Fire District 1. We got a records request in. There was a separate request that was made to one of their contract cities. And what I mean by that is the district served that city provided fire protection and EMS services. Same request came into both agencies, and the requester found that the documents they got from us, from the district, contained one more document than the city produced. And so the requester said, aha, public records violation, and went after the contract city, and that city settled for $50,000. Cool. And you think to yourself, well, that's a lot of money. Why did they do that? But when we start talking about the penalties that can be imposed for public records violations and the fact that the plaintiffs can get attorney's fees and costs, those costs can mount up quite quickly. And there are a number of cases, and sometimes during these presentations I give some examples just to kind of show how serious this act can be. I didn't do that this time. I left those cases out. But I want to just emphasize the point that it's important to know this stuff. Now, at the commissioner level, you don't need to remember this stuff in any detail. We've got a public records officer who goes through even additional training to what you're getting today, who handles these things. And Pam contacts our office regularly when we get a records request in to make sure that we are complying with the law. So we've got processes in place to deal with this. But the point is, these are, under the laws that now exist, this is a pretty severe pretty severe penalties can be imposed if you were to violate it. The plaintiff in these cases does not need to show any kind of damage. They're automatically entitled to penalties if there's a violation. Now, the penalty can be up to a maximum of $100 a day per record, which means often can mean per document. It could be a three-page document, could be a one-page document, so that's a record. Sometimes the courts will group documents together to say this is a category of records, but in any event, the maximum that can be assessed is $100 a day. And if you think about it, by the time a case winds its way through the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court, it can be huge. One of the first cases that I had when I moved to Bellingham, I was a lawyer down in Seattle initially at a large law firm, and I moved up and started practicing municipal law. And my boss at the time, Frank Schmelick, had had a call from the Port of Bellingham about whether this report should be disclosed pursuant to a public records request. And we made the decision that it was exempt under this one exemption that had never been the subject of a court case before. Well, the requester sued. And that case got appealed to the Court of Appeals and then to the Supreme Court years later. The court won on that, but had they lost, the penalties would have been extraordinary. So you have to take those kinds of factors into account whenever you were to deny a record. Is it worth it? Right. Okay, so enough about that. But I would say that this has, in the years since I've been doing this, seems to have developed a little bit into a niche practice for some lawyers. You see kind of the same lawyers over and over again that are bringing these kinds of cases. I think some of them probably take these cases on contingency fees. And some plaintiffs, like there's one, Arthur West, you may read about in the Seattle Times from time to time. It's a very common public records requester. And others like him look for instances where agencies have screwed up. And then they bring lawsuits over this kind of stuff. So it is important to understand this, what this means. Okay, I think I've talked about about this slide. The only thing I would say with public records requests, my advice is always stay in frequent communication with the requester, particularly when a request is going to take some time. And Pam, I know, does a good job of that. She communicates with us. I've filed public records requests of my own against, not against, but with the Department of Transportation. I had a piece of litigation involving the tunnel project. And Department of Transportation wrote back and said, this is going to take us months, 6 months to provide all of these documents. Well, it can take an agency that long. That's not an automatic violation of the Act, because if you think about DOT during that tunnel project, they're getting just mountains of public records requests coming in. As long as they're treating everybody the same and processing my request in the order in which it was received, I think they're doing what they can do. So we've had a few requests that have been sizable. It's taken some time. It takes some time to get the records together, to review them for exemptions, and to get them out. As long as you've got a process in place and are ensuring that you get all of the responsive records, that's the key. What is a public record? It's really anything that is either recorded digitally, electronically, or on paper that relates to the business of government. It needs to be either prepared, owned, or used, or retained by the agency. But the physical form of it is really relevant. If you're interested in the definition, I've got this slide here to just kind of show you that it's very all-encompassing. Public records can include things that could be on your home computers or on your iPads or stored on non-district machines or on non-district emails. So if you were to use, let's say, Gmail for your district business, now you've got a public record that sits in your Gmail account. And that means that you can't destroy it. It's subject to the records retention period. If we get a public records request that covers that, then you have to provide that. So a few tips that I always offer is, if you can, don't use personal emails. Keep your district emails business separate from your personal emails. That way you never have to go searching through your private emails to find out if you've got responsive records. Another tip is, if you can, avoid using your home computer or personal device for district business. Now, not every agency can do this. Some agencies provide their commissioners with a separate laptop. Use this laptop whenever you're doing district business. It can't be done because of cost reasons and so forth in every case, but it is something that is useful. Now, I say here that this is less important because of the Neeson case. So we had a case 2 years ago involving the Pierce County prosecuting attorney, and there was a records request made for his texts that were on his cell phone. Long story short, what we've known for years is that if you have a personal device, like a laptop that you do district business on, that could be searched in order to respond to a public records request. And it arises out of a Shoreline case from, 10 years ago or so. And so we have always told our municipal clients, don't use your personal devices, because we don't want to have those devices searched. The Supreme Court, a couple of years ago, in this Neeson case, came out with a very practical solution, which has kind of, I think, has ameliorated a lot of that concern. In that case, they said, as long as it was the prosecuting attorney, as long as he searched his personal devices for public records and completed an affidavit saying he had searched and provided all of the responsive documents and provided that to the agency, that's all that was required. So it's not as important these days, I don't think, if you wish to use a personal device or home computer to conduct district business. But you would have to fill out an affidavit saying you did your own search of that and you provided everything that was responsive. The problem from the agency standpoint is if you overlook something, because we are relying upon our employees now and our commissioners, elected officials, to provide those records. And it's not something that we can use our IT folks for, to go search your personal computer. If we overlook something, or if one of you were to overlook something in that search, and a requester were to realize that, then there could be subject to a violation. Not you personally, but the agency would. Again, you go back to those penalties, they're substantial. So I still like it when an agency can offer personal devices for use by commissioners, but if that's not possible, just keep in mind you may have to do that if we get a records request in that covers records on your personal devices. Some agencies experience, just because everybody likes to CC everybody else, you get all of these copies of one email now in everybody's email accounts, it becomes a storage issue, perhaps less so with the cloud retention that a lot of agencies use these days, but an email retention policy is not a bad idea. And because you can meet the intent of the law by keeping a record of every email that's sent without just filling up the agency storage with duplicates. From a public records responsive standpoint, it makes it a lot easier for us to respond to records requests because we don't, rather than have five or six copies of a record that we have to produce, we just have one. Right? It's easier for us to go through, it's easier for us to produce, but you need a policy because you need to figure out how are we going to ensure that at least one copy remains. Oftentimes what agencies will do is will impose on the sender of the email the burden of retaining that email. So we always have the sent version. And that person may have copied six different people. Those people can all delete their version. We've got the one, so we've kept the record, but we don't have a bunch of duplicates. If that's something that is becoming an issue for the district, then we can talk about that because a retention policy is often a good thing to have. Okay, Public Records Act, public records officers. Under the Act, you have to designate somebody to be the public records officer, and that's Pam in your case. There are procedures that need to be published by the agency describing the agency itself, operations, rules of procedure, and other items. And you need to adopt rules and procedures to deal with the public's access to public records. So those are just kind of the procedural requirements of the Act. Some additional aspects are you can charge for copies. It's less and less common these days for people to want paper copies. Sometimes they want to come in and inspect. Inspection is free. But if they want a copy, a lot of times it's easiest just to send it out electronically if we have it in that format. And so if you want to charge for paper copies that you provide or for digital copies, you can do that, but you need to publish a fee schedule. You are to make non-exempt records available for inspection and copying during customary business hours for a minimum of 30 hours a week. So if somebody wants to just come in and inspect, they don't want copies, don't measure hourly requirement. All right, so how does a public records request be made? Pam, let me ask you, do we have a form for public records requests?
There is a form on our district website if they want to fill that out, or I take them by email.
Okay. So records requests don't have to be made on the district's form. Oftentimes we encourage requesters to use the district's form because we can track it that way. We it's something we recognize as a records request. But a requester is not required to use that. They can send in an email, they can make a verbal request for records. The only thing is that they have to provide fair notice that they're making a public records request. First, they can't bury that in a three-page letter to the agency in such a way that it does not appear to us that a records request has been made. Requests can be sent in a bunch of different ways. They can be emailed, faxed. As I said, they can be verbal. But what that means is you kind of have to be aware of what a records request is and listen for it. And in the Shoreline case that I was talking about, that request was a verbal request. So the case that went up to the Supreme Court originated with a verbal request for records. So we have to kind of be aware of that. And when you get a verbal request, you talk to Pam and say, I got this, so that we can then put it into the system and start tracking it and get in touch with the requester. again, I always encourage people to try and encourage the requester to use the form. And a lot of times that's when we first get in touch with the requester, we say, would you mind filling out the form? Can't require them to do so, but it sure helps us in tracking. Sometimes what you'll get is a request for information, and that is not a public records form. So you'll get a letter or something from a citizen who says, I'd like to know the following things. You can choose to answer those or not, but if you did not answer that, that would not be a violation of Public Records Act, because that's not a request for identifiable public records. That's a request for information, which is not covered by the Public Records Act. All right, and just some details here which are more important to Pam, but which I'll go over just so you're kind of, so you understand what the process is. When we get a records request in, we have 5 days to respond, 5 business days. And there, that response can take the form of, here's the record, we've got it, we found it, here you go. We can, if we've got the record posted on the website, we can refer the requester to the website. We can tell the requester that we got your request and it's going to take us some time. We're estimating 10 days, a month, whatever it is, depending on the size of the request, how many places we have to go to get documents that are responsive. We'll issue a reasonable estimate. And if we bump up against that reasonable estimate, let's say we told the requester it'll be a week, and we're coming up on a week and we don't have it done yet because of whatever, we ran into a problem, we'll tell the requester it'll take us an additional period of time. So you can kind of keep, as long as you, like I say, keep in touch with the requester, you're meeting the intent of the act. Sometimes we get a request in that we just don't understand all of it or part of it, and we are entitled to get back in touch with the requester and say, what is it that you're looking for? We're not sure what you have in mind here. We can also deny the request, but in order to do that, denying means we've got the record. It's a public record, but it's exempt. And so what you have to do there is to let the requester know why the record's not being produced and what exemption applies. When it comes to estimating the time for further response, which often happens, we need more than just the 5 business days to get the records. Our estimate of that time has to be reasonable. And I like to, just so the requester knows, we are processing the request. We're not, you know, shoving their request to the side. We tell them, we talk to them about why it is that we need more time. Sometimes it's rare, but sometimes we need to notify third parties and let them know this request came in, and they may wish to take action to try and keep those records from being produced. I've never yet, in over 20 years of doing this, seen more than one case where a third party did that, but that right is available to them. So it does happen from time to time. I think I've gone over this. Again, we can extend the time as we need in order to get the records to the requester. And the one thing about that is, if it's going to take us a long time, but we're getting records requests in and processed, I like to issue those in installments so that the requester can get installments rather than just wait for a big batch when we're all done. If this is going to take us a month or 2 months, we will have some records available within that, short of that, and the Public Records Act allows us to produce those in an installment basis. That usually makes the requesters a little bit more satisfied. They realize that things are getting done. They get to see some records in the interim. Meanwhile, we keep processing the balance. All right, now, it may sound easy to search for responsive records, but a lot of times where we spend the bulk of our effort is on, we get a request in, and it's kind of a comprehensive request. We know it's going to take some effort. We have to come up with a strategy to get all of the responsive records. And this is the stuff that's behind the scenes that Pam does in consultation with us and with the IT folks. How do we get these records? We want to make sure we get every last one, right? So if we need to clarify the request, we do that, and then we come up with a strategy for where are these records likely to be located? What do we use keyword search? Do we have our IT guys, plug in some some keywords in order to get all responsive emails. What do we do? That's, again, is something that goes on behind the scenes, literally on every request, because we're concerned about making sure that we gather all of the responsive records. The reason that is important is because courts require the agencies to undertake a search that is reasonably calculated to uncover responsive records. And that means you've got an obvious lead, you've got to follow that to those locations where the records are likely to be found. And what I always tell folks, and I know Pam does this, is she documents the efforts that we undergo so that we have a record of everything that we did to prove that we undertook a reasonable search. All right, now, just like with the Open Public Meetings Act, where, you know, executive session is kind of the exception to the rule, in the Public Records Act, exemptions are the exception, right, exception to the rule. The general rule is everything's a public record and it's open for the public to be able to see unless there's a precise exemption that applies. The burden's on us as the agency to show why a record is exempt. If we are going to not produce a record, we have to provide an exemption log which has the following information: the date of record, what kind of record it is, whether it's a memo, a letter, or something like that, who the author and recipient is, how long is it, and why it's being withheld. In other words, we have to look at the statute and figure out which exemption applies and list it there as the basis for withholding the record. The exemption log is a requirement of the Public Records Act if you're going to hold on to a record. Now, one of the things that sometimes happens is we can redact part of the record, and the rest of the record is not exempt. So in those cases, we use the least intrusive means of just taking out the part that is exempt, still provide the exemption log, but the requester sees the balance of the record. What kinds of exemptions do we often rely upon? These are, again, there are a number in the Act that are available, but the primary ones are attorney-client privilege, pretty obvious one, protected health information. So you get a request for something to include somebody's protected health information. Oftentimes we may be able to redact part of that, not always, depends on the form that's involved. Pending investigative records, if we're conducting an investigation, this exemption probably does not apply to the public hospital district. Certain information, and I want to say certain, because not the personnel records, there are parts of them that are disclosable and other parts that are not. And when a request comes in for records that are personnel related, you just have to go back to, there's a series of cases that apply to this and statute. Bottom, the thing that I always try and keep in the back of my mind is if it involves somebody's right to privacy, their social security number, their date of birth, things of that nature, are oftentimes, those are the things that are exempt. Not everything in a personal health file is going to be exempt, though. So you have to deal with that on a case-by-case basis. The last exemption is one that is called deliberative process. And what it means is if you get a memo from, say, the superintendent, who is expressing some opinions about how to carry out the board's policies. If it contains opinions, then that can be exempt so long as the decision has not been made by the board. Once the board has made the decision, that record loses its exemption. Okay, we've talked about enforcement and penalties. I don't need to go over those again. I've said enough on the scary parts of the Act. But when a court looks at determining what an appropriate penalty is, it takes into account a bunch of factors, both mitigating and aggravating factors, and then decides what's most appropriate. If you're an egregious violator of the Public Records Act, you probably have a bunch of aggravating factors, and the penalty will be closer to the maximum. Some of the things the court can take into account that can reduce a penalty are, if the requester submitted a request that just wasn't clear, we tried our best, we didn't really understand, no reasonable person would have understood what the requester was getting after, can reduce a penalty. if we were, you know, in close contact with the requester at all time, we acted promptly, we asked for clarification, didn't get it. And I think we've even had a situation where we've asked for, at this district, where we've asked for clarification, and the requester said, I'm not going to do it. Well, then we do the best we can. What we normally do is we say, well, we think your request means this, and this is what we're going to look for. If you disagree, let us know. Because, I mean, we can't mind read. We can only interpret to the best of our ability, but we let that person know, here's what we think you're asking for. If you think something different, let us know. If you've been properly your staff and personnel have been properly trained, that's a mitigating factor, and so forth and so on. I'll let you read through that later. But there are a bunch of aggravating factors, too, that can increase the penalty. If we delay responding, if we're not timely in our response, if we don't have published policies and procedures, if we lack proper training, if we don't undertake this kind of class on a regular basis, or if we acted unreasonably, things of that nature can cause a court to increase the penalty. There's another slide here with other bad acts that an agency can do that can increase the penalty, such as being dishonest about, well, we didn't tell the requester we had this record. We didn't put it on an exemption log. We just didn't tell them we had it. That's not a good thing. Courts don't like to see that. So there are sometimes records that you'd rather not disclose. It happens all the time. But the act is the act, and we have to comply. And that means sometimes records get disclosed that we may not want. A public records officer is, again, is a requirement of the statute. So you have to appoint somebody to fulfill that role. They serve as the primary contact with a member of the public who wants records. They oversee the compliance of the agency with the act, and just they handle it. And again, a lot of that involves kind of coordination with legal counsel.